Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today we have a bonus episode for all of you. We've been taking a little time off, and we're coming back next week with a new episode of The Road to Now Theology. But since we've been gone so long, we thought it might be nice to share with you an appearance that Bob and I did on one of our favorite history podcasts, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics with Bruce Carlson. If you listen to this podcast, you know Bruce. He's been on our podcast several times. He did the live event with us at Avis at the Beach. He is a remarkable podcaster, and if you've been looking for something to enjoy while we're taking time off, we recommend you go check out My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. But like I said, we've got a new episode of Road to Now Theology coming next week. We have another episode on immigration that we've recorded about nativism with David Bennett, a great author. That'll be coming up in the next few weeks. We've got a lot of great things coming up, and we're really excited. And we just thought, since we've got another week left, we'd like to share this episode with you. It features a great conversation about Elvis Presley, his impact on American culture and beyond. It also features what I think is one of the greatest stories I've ever heard Bob Crawford tell about his Elvis t-shirt when he went to a Journey concert. It's amazing. In fact, this story was so great that I decided for Christmas this year to get Bob Crawford a new Elvis Presley t-shirt. And when you hear this interview, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. This episode originally aired in September. But it's one of those evergreens, so it keeps going. A couple of other things. First of all, I am now in Los Angeles, where I'll be for a couple of weeks. I've got some great shows coming up. If you want to come hear me do stand-up comedy, you can check my website, sawyercomedy.com. This Saturday night, the 14th, I'll be at the Comedy Store. I've got some other shows lined up around here, so go check that out, and I'd love to have you come out. I know from our numbers that we had a lot of people come to our podcast after some of you heard me on Love It or Leave It, which was a great experience. If you like me there, I was being both historian and comic, come see my comic side, and hopefully I won't disappoint you. Aside from that, we'd like to thank everyone on Patreon. Bob and I have been maintaining work there, and just not long ago, we launched an interview with Cracker Farm that's available for our patrons. I've known Bob and Cracker a long time, but I didn't know how they met. And I listened to that episode kind of like a fan because I wasn't there. They were out in Red Rocks when they recorded it. And it made me laugh. It's a great episode. So for our patrons, you've probably already heard it. If not, you can go there and support The Road to Now. Help us keep making these things that we're making. And we always appreciate it. There's a lot of extra content there that if you're dying for some new content from us since we've been taking the break, listen to this episode with Bruce Carlson and then go check out our Patreon feed. There are a lot of extra episodes there that you probably haven't heard. So thank you for listening to The Road to Now. We hope you enjoy this episode, and we look forward to sharing the new Road to Now theology with you next week and following with a lot of new episodes. Take care.
August 16th, 1977, Elvis Presley dies. Not just a mere entertainer in the way that we know entertainers today, somebody with a few songs, but just a critical figure in American music and culture. He was to go and perform that night. A tragic story, and immediately people start filling the streets of Memphis around Elvis Presley Boulevard, you know, say it isn't so. And I know for my own family, my mother, Joanne, was a huge Elvis fan. To this day, I still retain the Elvis bust lamp that she had. She was a member of the Northern New Jersey Knights for Elvis. And, you know, and we went on picnics as a kid. When I got the chance to go down to Graceland as a college student, back when I was at Stockton along with Bob, I saw one of the flowers on his grave was from the Northern New Jersey Knights for Elvis, so I got the chance to. Obviously, Elvis was very big in the Carlson family, and while I don't, unfortunately, have a memory of the day, My sister talks about how distraught my mother was on it, and of course she talked about it a lot and retained the newspapers.
Our family was on vacation in Florida on that day, and I had this memory of my mother being very upset and crying, and I asked her, when you asked us to come on the show and talk about this topic, I called her, and I was like, what do you remember from that day, and did you get upset? Because I didn't want to say, you cried the day Elvis died, but she told me she cried. She was very upset when Elvis died, and I think it's, and the more I thought about, you know, Ben and I coming on the show and thought about what is Elvis's impact on American culture today? Because Bruce, when you and I were young, I know Ben's a little younger than us, but before Elvis, the greatest pop culture, if you will, American figure was Charles Lindbergh. And Elvis was the first. He was the first pop superstar. And so for anyone who's under 40 and lived through Michael Jackson and everything and the pop culture mm-hmm. explosion that followed the 80s, you know, I mean, Elvis was gone in the 80s. And pop culture exploded. MTV, People Magazine, you know, this Entertainment Tonight, this whole culture of celebrity. It wasn't what it, as big as it became, as it is today, as it was when Elvis was present and with us. And so how could someone who didn't live through Elvis's passing and have memories of the aftermath, and it was a sensation, wasn't it, Bruce? I mean, I remember having Elvis coloring books at that point. Like, everything on television was Elvis.
He was merchandising before Kiss and all those bands took it up, and before the Star Wars phenomenon. I mean, there was Elvis everything, and the concerts were huge.
And what about the tabloid aspect of his passing?
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing with his doctor, what happened to his body after he died, and the rumors of how he died and where he died, and this was all very sensationalistic. And it's kind of that kind of a celebrity, it's almost become cliche, right? A celebrity dies of a drug overdose. Meh.
Yeah, now we make the fuss that was made over Elvis with almost everyone. We do it maybe for a shorter time, but he was an iconic figure, and some of that, I think, comes back to his origin on the scene of rock and roll music, and he was just a phenom. Because we're talking about the event, we're talking about the older Elvis and Elvis's death, we also have to think about the younger Elvis. And, of course, when they had that famous postage stamp competition, and they had the decision between did you want the older Elvis on the stamp or the younger Elvis? The younger Elvis won. I voted for the older Elvis, by the way. Put that. But that was the memory that a lot of people had, and he came on the scene and kind of changed pop culture.
Well, Bob just said, you know, anyone who did not live through that, you know, what would it be like? I can answer that question. We're coming up on the 39th anniversary of my birth on October 4th, which means I actually was born about 14 months after Elvis passed away, so I don't remember him as anything. And the generation gap, I think, can be told that whenever Bob said Elvis and tabloids, mm-hmm. all I thought about was all the tabloids when I was a kid that said Elvis was still alive. You know,
isn't it interesting that I think we're finally at the point where you don't hear as much of the Elvis is a still alive talk, but that was big in the 80s.
Well, I can say this, though, Bruce, that one of my students mm-hmm. came to class about a year ago and asked me if I had read the story about how they discovered Elvis was alive, living in a small town in Tennessee, and he was homeless, and he was trying to wash people's windshields. And I will say that was a teaching moment where I asked them to break down how evidence works and whether or not they could use their tools of rationality to demonstrate whether or not that was true.
Mm-hmm. Can you falsify it?
My father, this is kind of an interesting story. My father was going to Central Piedmont Community College in 1972, and his friend worked at the hotel right next to the old Charlotte Coliseum where Elvis had played. And Elvis stayed in the hotel his friend worked at. This was 72, I think. And my dad got him to take him into Elvis's room right after Elvis had left before they cleaned up, just to kind of see what was going on in there. And my dad said that even at that point, they walked in, and the floor was just strewn with syringes, disposable syringes. As I got on, I'll tell you, there's some great stuff about Elvis and the Soviet Union, which, you know, that's Soviet history is my specialty. It's pretty fascinating how he became a worldwide superstar. And even they tried to keep him from, they tried to keep Soviet citizens from getting access to Elvis Presley's music. And they made sure they got it.
I have to point out that right there, my grandmother and the Soviet Union were working towards the same end, because she did not want my mother listening to Elvis up until a point when Elvis appeared on Ed Sullivan. And Ed Sullivan said, "He's a decent boy. He's thoroughly all right. Thoroughly all right." I don't know if anybody, I wouldn't take that as a compliment anymore if someone said, "Bruce, you're thoroughly all right." But once Ed Sullivan said it, then my mother was allowed to listen to some of music. And then when he joined the Army, certainly he was acceptable.
You know, and that appearance on Ed Sullivan, it changed the course of music history, right? Mm-hmm. How many future rock stars from Bruce Springsteen on kind of pinpoint that moment? That was the moment they wanted to put a guitar in their own hands. And so Elvis literally changed the course of music history, and he was the birth of rock and roll,
right,
as we know it, right? I mean,
of course,
we could talk about the rhythm and blues of Memphis, but he was a white man who sounded like a black man, and that was a commodity that was unmatched at the time, and it changed music forever.
I think the culture, the young Elvis, that phenom that moved his legs, that shook things, had cultural, even political influences. It made rock and roll popular, which brought it to conflict with authorities, which brought it to conflict with older people, set up how younger people felt and what they should be doing. It came at the same time as TV sets were increasing and all of those things. And I think that so many people were influenced by it. You know, there's the famous story of Springsteen on the Born to Run tour, jumps over the gates of Graceland. I mean, this is while Elvis is still using it as a house. He didn't happen to be there. So Springsteen has to get escorted out. I don't think they got arrested or anything, but, you know, they. So that's how powerful an influence it was.
Well,
on
and
him.
Springsteen's song Fire was written for Elvis. Springsteen wrote it for Elvis to perform. The Pointer Sisters, I think, recorded it, but it was written for Elvis.
You know, I did not know that. A lot of people wrote for Elvis. You know, that's one of the things you hear, like, oh, he didn't write his own songs, but people love to write for him. As a cultural icon, he's very important. The older Elvis is the image a lot of times in our mind, but when you look at some of those old, like, Milton Berle appearances and think about what it must have been like in the 50s to have this very young person, a millennial of his time, this kind of like very different guy with weird hair, moving his legs in a weird way. He wasn't political per se, but that in and of itself, I might argue, had a political effect in how people acted and on the culture and on what people felt they could do. Hey, it's okay to go out and dance, you know, because this guy's doing it on TV.
When you said you wanted to talk about Elvis, I was like, I got to get ready for this. So I watched a bunch of interviews with Elvis, you know, went back and read up on his history and all of this. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's amazing about him is that he's a rebel for his time. But when you see him interviewed, he doesn't speak like that. He actually is so respectful. He, when people ask him, you know, I saw some interviews when he was in the Army, and they said, you know, because apparently all the different branches of the Army tried to get him to come there. Air Force said that we will send you around to recruit. The Navy offered something special, and he was like, no, I'm just going to go in as a GI. And they asked him, do the people here give you a hard time? Do the other soldiers give you a hard time? And he said, well, I suspect they would if they saw me getting special treatment, but I make sure that I don't. And he served like everyone else. They asked him, are you going to stop shaking your legs around? Can you stop doing that? And he wasn't like, no, I'm not going to do that. That's what I... He said, no, I can't do that. That's just what I got to do. That's the way I am, and that's the way my music is. And it was never a flaunted in your face. It was always just that this is just what it is. It's me. And I think that's amazing. He didn't hype himself as a rebel, is what I'm saying.
You know, it's funny. When I was in high school and like freshman, maybe 1986, listening to punk rock, getting very into that culture, Elvis is the young rebel Elvis was a very predominant figure in that culture. And there was almost a renaissance of that 50s, the rockabilly, the rockabilly Elvis is what I'm trying to say. Mike Ness, I mean, think about, you know, all the bands like that. And even, but you think of the Stray Cats and that it was that rebel rockabilly rebel Elvis. And when you would go to, there were some punk rock stores in South Street in Philadelphia we would go to. And this is, again, the early to mid 80s. And these, you would have T-shirts of Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols. You'd have T-shirts of the Ramones or the Dead Kennedys. But you'd also have alongside them, you had T-shirts of young Elvis. And so it's like, this is like 5-10 years after his passing. But here you see the beginning of this this commercial icon, if you will, or this, there's something about young Elvis that embodies something in the American spirit. And you see teenagers in the 80s beginning to wear shirts with Elvis on it.
One of the most requested documents from the National Archives is the photo of Elvis and Nixon. And the webpage where they feature it is still one of the most visited webpages of the National Archives, which is kind of a funny thing when you think about it, because this is the agency that also has the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Yet Elvis and Nixon it is. There's a bit to the story of Elvis's visit with Nixon, and we get into it on the premium podcast where My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. So if you're not signed up, it's as little as $2 a month. Sign up today. www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We've got a link to the premium podcast there. It can be as little as $2 a month. We're going to go over the story of Elvis's visit with Nixon, what he was looking for, and there's some documents from the Nixon administration side of things about that visit. So sign up now.
And, you know, I actually have an Elvis T-shirt story. Would you guys like to hear it?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. I was probably a sophomore in high school, and I went to see a Journey concert. Do you guys remember the band Journey?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Had a lot of hits in the 70s, 80s. And it was the Raised on Radio tour, I think. So this is the end. This is probably the last tour with Steve Perry. And we get third row tickets, and it was just a big deal, and it was three of us went. And I had a t-shirt, and it was Elvis Presley and his, you know, like rebel Elvis, but it was like kind of a drawing, almost like a cartoon, and he was in the background was a rebel flag. So it's like his rebel flag background and Elvis's, like, you know, young crooner face, maybe a piece of a leather jacket in there. And I wore that concert, or I wore that shirt to the concert, and it was the Spectrum in Philadelphia. Bruce, did you ever go to the Spectrum in Philadelphia for anything, any concerts?
I went there for a Bruce Springsteen concert.
Okay. So we're at the show, and I buy a Journey t-shirt, okay? And I put my Journey t-shirt on during the show, or like before the show starts, and I'm holding my Elvis t-shirt. And at the encore, The band Journey, they do, I think either Jailhouse Rock or Heartbreak Hotel. I can't remember. And I hold up my Elvis t-shirt, and Steve Perry points to me and he says, you know, give me your shirt. And I threw the shirt on stage, and he put the shirt on. And so I'm like 15 years old.
Oh.
And so he's wearing my Elvis t-shirt, singing, I can't remember, I feel like it was Jailhouse Rock. I wonder if I could go back and look at a set list online to find out. But he's wearing my shirt. It's on the big Jumbotron. Wow. And he's singing this Elvis song. It's just this amazing moment, this amazing moment. So the show ends. That was like probably the absolute last song they played. They walk off the stage, and I'm just dumbfounded that he didn't give me my shirt back. I couldn't believe that was my favorite shirt. I've never seen that shirt or a shirt like it since. And I asked the security guard. And at this point, like, now I'm in the music business. I've been in the music business for 16 years. I know how this goes, right? But I'm asking the security guard, you know, hey, man, can you get my shirt back? He has my shirt. The guy that was, who has your shirt, sir? The guy who was on stage singing the song has my shirt. I want my shirt back. Can you please get my shirt back? And it went from me being big Journey fan, like lights, loving, touching, squeezing, wheel in the fire, you know, like I'm just loving Journey, like to just automatically hating Journey. Before I left that concert, I denounced Journey. I denounced Steve Perry. I almost do to this day. I still like that live album from the 70s. But that's my Elvis t-shirt story. And if I ever meet Steve Perry, which could happen. It could happen. It's not out of the realm of possibility. It won't be any niceties. It'll be right to the shirt. Hey, man, I want my shirt.
Well, look, I mean, I know this is a long shot, but I'm going to go for it on your behalf. Like, look, Steve Perry, if you're listening to this podcast, you need to get your shirt, the Elvis t-shirt, back to Bob Crawford, okay?
Which is funny because I forgot it until we were 20 minutes into the podcast.
No, that's fine. I think what it speaks to, though, is how powerful Elvis is just, maybe not universally loved is a strong term because there's some people like, oh, no, I don't. But far more popular than any artist at a time and just universally popular by so many different types of people. Look, I mean, really a big North and South artist, you know, and an international star. However, his death in 1977, the one thing that will always strike me about it is how young. We're talking about a guy, you know, born in 35, so he's 42 years old when he dies. All of that iconic status, all of that attention. And yeah, there's celebrities and musicians that die at the 27 and things like that. They're usually people who have one good thing, you know, but for someone like that, an icon, passing at such a young age. And I remember being younger and telling my mom, because I was young, so the 40s seemed like an old age to me. It certainly doesn't now. You know, oh, he was so old. And my mother was like, no, he was young. And it's true. And so just a tragic passing. And I think that speaks to, you know, some issues that we have today, because certainly Elvis had an addiction problem. I do remember that at the time, there was a much bigger separation between prescription drugs and abuse of illegal drugs. And this was something that my mother, as a big Elvis fan, drew a distinction on. It's probably a distinction we wouldn't make much today. Certainly the doctor was, his license taken away, was, I believe they attempted to prosecute him and Shelby County. But I think we were denied an example that might have been useful to people in later years because of his iconic status, and you didn't want to talk about that with Elvis.
Yes, Elvis's doctor was George Nikopoulos. Does that sound right?
That's right. It was Dr. Nicky is the way
yeah,
I was
and
always.
He, didn't he go... He denied that he had anything to do with Elvis's death, and then didn't he go on tour with his medical bag and some of the drugs or the jewelry that Elvis had given him over the years, and he kind of had this little sideshow?
I don't recall the specifics, but it sounds right. I mean the tabloid around Elvis, but certainly it was I think like the recent book title says, you know, A Careless Love. There was really no one who could stop him. He was actually a master of the pharmacopoeia, and he knew a lot about prescription drugs, and Dr. Nick was more of a vehicle to get the drugs. I just want to jump in with a clarification about Elvis and his doctor based on what Bob and I were talking about there. It's an interesting story, does relate a bit to drug policy. Dr. George Nikopoulos died in 2016 and took with him, of course, a legacy of some people seeing him as a killer. He was indeed prosecuted in 1983, years after Presley's death. Now, the difficulty in prosecuting him was for two reasons. One is the cause of Presley's death was not so certain. The early news reports said that he just merely had a heart attack. And it was only later that some blood specimens were tested to determine he had died of drug abuse was a contributing factor. But because there was such difference of opinion about the death, you know, that was one reason. The other reason that Dr. Nick was let off, he was a well-regarded and well-known doctor and had many friends in the medical community and many patient friends. Later, it's actually in 1995, 20 years after Elvis's death, Dr. Nikopoulos's license is taken away. For similar reasons, the medical board found that he was prescribing too much to patients. He felt, of course, strongly that it was still a reaction to his role in Elvis's death. Dr. Nick started treating Elvis in 1967. And, you know, there's two sides to it. On the one hand, he wrote Elvis' prescription for 10,000 doses over the time he was treating him of uppers, downers, and associated narcotics. In 1967, he started treating Elvis Presley because of his insomnia. To hear Dr. Nick's side of the story was that he informed Presley several times that he was taking too many pills, the combination of upper and downers could be bad for his health, and he found that Presley would get frustrated and go to other doctors if he didn't get what he wanted. And sometimes he did indeed not prescribe to Elvis. Elvis's problem, Dr. Nick said, was that he didn't see the wrong in it. He felt that by getting them from a doctor, he wasn't the common everyday junkie. On the road, he was so afraid that he wouldn't get enough sleep to do a good show the next night that he would end up asking you for an extra pill or two. And indeed, sometimes Dr. Nick would give him placebos. When Elvis asked for a shot that he didn't need, Dr. Nick would wait till his back was turned, squirt the liquid on the floor, and then inject his patient with an emptied syringe. Tablets were trickier, but he persuaded Knoll, the manufacturers of one of Elvis's favorite painkillers, to press a special batch of 1,000 pills without any active ingredients. It's hard to convince somebody what's right and wrong or what they need to do. It's hard when you've got somebody who thinks they have all the answers, and no matter what you throw at them, they've got answers for you. Elvis was a very smart guy, Dr. Nick said. Not to have any college education, he was well-read. He carried more books on the road than we carried drugs. I mean, suitcases, 3 big steamer trunks full of books. Yet he was always childlike with these things about taking drugs. I don't think he ever realized how harmful these things could be to him. If he got a sore throat and I gave him a penicillin tablet, I gave him 20 to take, saying, you take 4 a day of these things until you use them up. So he's going to take 8 or 12 a day until he uses them up, because he thinks he'll get well faster that way. It was certainly a stupid decision on his part, but he wasn't a stupid man. He was really a smart guy. But I do recall that distinction being made in the past of this difference between, oh, it's okay, it was prescription drugs, which now we know the problem with that when that's unleashed, and the recent problems we've been having.
If we could have learned that lesson at that point in life, we would have spared ourselves a lot of trouble, I think. It is a shame sometimes whenever we shield ourselves. One of the things that I think is interesting is, like, looking at I was listening to interviews with folks who toured with Elvis, and what was amazing was that, you know, the role Colonel Tom Parker played in all of this, because he would, you know, this, I guess he was a notorious gambler. He would lose $500,000 in a night, and basically he took 50% of what Elvis made. And I remember one of the folks who toured with him was in an interview was saying, Colonel Tom Parker had some influence over Elvis, and we all hoped that he, you know, we all figured he hadn't seen the side of Elvis, the trouble he was having with the drugs and everything. He said, and one night Elvis was in a room just ruined from all the drugs, and he said he thought, well, this is good. He'll see it. And he said Tom Parker went in the room, and a few minutes later he walked in, the guy who was with him walked inside and said that Tom Parker was there, like holding his hair or something like this, like helping him get through the detox. And he looked at the other guy and said, "The only thing that matters is that Elvis plays the show tonight."
Mm-hmm.
And you think about it, if you're with friends like those, how tragic it is that basically this guy was addicted to gambling. So he was addicted to the money that Elvis brought in.
It was a complex relationship with Tom Parker, and I think it's probably something that a lot of musicians go through. But it was, you know, one thing that's interesting about the Tom Parker story is even after his death, Vernon and the estate make the same deal with Tom Parker, 50%. So it was an extremely enormous manager's fee. But then again, here was this fellow from, you know, Tennessee who was playing some dairy fairs, and, you know, Tom Parker exposed him to new heights of dollars, but yes, took a higher percentage of those dollars, and that was always the argument. It's not an argument that would hold up much at this time. He also did things like one of the reasons that so many of those movies were done during the 60s, and while a few of them are good, I love King Creole, but some of them are really, you know, should not have been made. Colonel Parker not only got a cut of those, but also got a fee as a technical director. So like maybe $30,000 for some of them on each movie made, in addition to getting his usual manager's fee. So he led Elvis to some bad places career-wise. Elvis was denied a concert at the White House because Tom Parker wanted a fee, and the White House was not going to pay. So wow. there's factors like that, I think. And the one of the greatest musical moments for Elvis was when he broke away for one concert, and that was the comeback concert in 68, December 68. And what had happened is he had been walking the streets of Sunset Boulevard, and he walked all the way down the street. And he had made so many movies, and he had been on the screen, but there were so many new musicians coming in the 60s. The Beatles had come and everybody else. And he walked down the street in Sunset Strip, and nobody said a word to him. And after Wow. that, he said, "I've got to do something." And he got a different producer. Tom Parker reluctantly agreed to it. And he did the comeback special, which features some of the best songs that he's ever done. I mean, the highlight being...
There's no doubt. Yeah, that is...
If I Can Dream, and is such a fantastic moment. He's there in the white suit.
Yeah, interesting side note. Colonel Tom Parker's house is about just a couple miles from mine here in Nashville, up at in East Nashville / Madison area. Wow. And it just went up for sale. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, if you meet the old-timers around here, they'll tell you about how they remember Elvis driving up Gallatin Avenue up to Tom Parker's house in his convertible when they were kids.
I want to talk a bit about, because it's My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, I think the one political issue that you can really put Elvis into is this whole debate over the shut up and sing debate. Should musicians not get into politics or get into politics? And one of the things about Elvis that I think keeps coming up is he had a press conference, he's asked about the Vietnam War, and he says, "Ma'am, I'm just an entertainer. I would rather not get into that." And that quote has been replayed and replayed and sometimes used in debates as a pro kind of shut up and saying musicians shouldn't be involved. See, Elvis said that. But, you know, I mean, a couple things. First of all, he was generally a polite guy, as we mentioned. He also, the question was about the Vietnam War, not just about politics in general. And the rest of that quote is that he said that when he was asked, should other entertainers do that, he said no. And Elvis was probably more involved in politics than that statement would probably indicate. Just the very fact of the type of music he played, that he was using African-American music, that he was shaking his legs on TV and acting in a different way from other musicians or jazz musicians might have done at that time. And sometimes a little on the conservative side. He was, you know, at least in the later years, he was a... He was meeting with Nixon. He was kind of anti-hippie. He didn't like the overboard extreme stuff. So there's all kinds of ways that he's involved in politics. But there is that quote of, you know, for the shut up and sing debate. I wonder, particularly for you, Bob, since you are a musician, how you feel about that debate.
You know, Bruce, I go back and forth over this because I think that the jeopardy some entertainers put themselves in is speaking on things that they just don't know a whole lot about. and or they're not super well informed about certain issues and they speak out on it, and or the way they speak out, it becomes more about them than it is about the issue itself. I think we saw that with Madonna at the Women's March.
Right.
I think you kind of see it in a way with Kathy Griffin, what she did recently. I think that it just becomes, it's more about the entertainer. Now, then you have Bono, who I spoke with someone who was a part of the Bush administration. And when Bono was going to Africa and working with George W. Bush on HIV issues and African issues, he would be sitting down in a room with African leaders, and he'd be the most well-informed man in that room about these issues. I mean, even more so than the African leaders themselves. So you have people like Bono who are the complete real deal, and then you have people who are just kind of jumping on the bandwagon, or maybe they're moved, but they're not informed. And so it's a tough road to walk. You know, I know our band, it's been tough for us because there are things that we've wanted to maybe get involved in, and we held back because things should kind of play out. And I think the person who should be the people directly affected by the issue, they should be the ones in the front row or the ones on the podium making the speech. You know, I think the celebrity, they can do other things to help. They can fund. They can give money. They can lift up and provide these groups that they have compassion for with support, but they don't need to be the face of it. Now, I've personally done a lot of work with St. Jude because my daughter had a brain tumor and she is a St. Jude patient. And so I know that I've walked that road. I've completely walked that road, the good and the bad of it. I know it. I know it inside out. And then there's the CBD oils, which I support, the legalization of medical marijuana, because I do know who children who have had their lives changed because of it. So those are issues I feel very comfortable speaking out on. Other issues, not so much. And I think it comes down to how well informed is the person. Sometimes I feel like the entertainer, if they want to get in politics, and for all of us, we all have an opinion. Twitter, I mean, go on Twitter or Facebook. Everyone's got their political opinions. Well, maybe we should be running for office. Maybe we should be on the school board. We should be in the county commission. We should be running as a state representative, state senator. You know,
more local issue.
Local issues or national. I mean, throw your hat in the ring. You know, I mean, it's the kind of thing is we all have an opinion. And I think our founders I don't think they meant for the career politician. I think they meant was for 2 years or 6 years, men and women, well, at the time men, but men and women would step up and say, I will carry the burden of my community for this, for I will do my time. And then it's like civil service, and it's like doing jury duty, right? We all say, okay, it's my turn. It's my turn to carry the weight for my community. And so.
Yeah, that sounds like
and that's
good
what
advice.
Ben and I tried to do on our show. We try to, we do have opinions, but we always try to leave room for the things that we might be ignorant of, and always listen to someone who may make a good point, even though we disagree, but maybe their good point will allow us to further reflect. So I just don't think it's cut and dry.
And can I add something to that too, as the third party person who has a podcast with a guy who is a musician? I only hear people complaining about people in entertainment. Bob's absolutely right. You got to be informed about it. And I like Bob's idea, concept of like being moved versus being, being educated. But I'll just say this, as someone who works with Bob, I think we would be impoverished if we decided that Bob didn't get to have a voice because he is also a talented musician. I mean, in a way, it's penalizing someone for having multiple talents. I think that you, if a person is informed, that's the measure. It doesn't matter what they do otherwise. As someone who oftentimes I'll start making a point and somebody will go, of course you think that, you're a college professor. You know what I'm saying? I only have to hear one person do that at a time, not thousands, because I don't have that type of audience. But it's unfair. You judge a person by their ideas.
If we're truly a democracy, everyone gets speech And I think Bob makes a good point. It's like, speak, but speak what you're informed about. Whenever I hear Shut Up and Sing, I just think about Bob Dylan. And I'm like, is someone going to say that to him? You know, just play music, little man. Just play notes and entertain us. It's like, no, there's a message behind these things. I mean, when most works of art, and if the issue's right and you're informed on it, Elvis's statement, ma'am, I'm not going to speak about the Vietnam War, you know, but he did go and visit Richard Nixon, though.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the first national celebrities in the United States, if we're to talk about what celebrity means, the first national celebrity is Benjamin Franklin. The second person, the other one during Franklin's day was him and George Washington. So to be fair, if you want to make people knowing who you are, you know, a qualification for not being listened to, you got pretty bad historical precedent to that.
Hey, and you can't forget George Whitefield, the evangelist of the 1730s, the 1750s of the First Great Awakening. He was, before George Washington, the most well-known man in North America.
Well, I think the clergy in early American history, I mean, it's worthy of a whole podcast itself, the clergy in American history were the Elvises. I mean, they were the pop stars. You would go to a church to hear this great new preacher or minister. You would want to read their books. I mean, Cotton Mather and all of his history of when John Witherspoon joined the independence movement, or even when he just went to Princeton, that was a huge boon for that school, for the revolutionary cause, certainly.
Bruce, it was Benjamin Franklin, and Benjamin Franklin estimated George Whitefield spoke in front of 20. He went to one of his speeches. He estimated he spoke in front of 20,000 people.
Wow.
20,000 people without a microphone.
Yeah, that's amazing.
For that time. Think about that. I think that was the one where Ben Franklin said that he couldn't stop himself from giving money, so he just brought less money to his sermons, because otherwise he would live.
And Ben Franklin was a skeptic, and he was right. Moved by Whitefield. Somebody help me out here.
these were people of fame, and the and would have been viewed as celebrities and key spokesperson in their time.
I think it's Whitefield, by the way.
I think that's right. Yeah, pronunciation's always fun with the podcast. You know, with the week. Ben, do you want to talk about the Soviet Union and Elvis?
I'd love to, because I read up on this. I was just going through old newspaper articles, and one of the fascinating things is there was this. You know, Elvis was huge. People knew him there. And there's a myth that, you know, they couldn't get it, but they could. And there were various ways. My favorite story came from my advisor at Appalachian State, who was born in the Soviet Union in the 1950s, grew up in Vladikavkaz in the Caucasus Mountains in the 1970s. He was there, and he would go up into the hills where they could get above the squelching, I guess, the Soviet Union sent out, and they would record the Voice of America rock and roll music and bring it back down. They had tape players. But the most amazing way was called Rok na Kostiak, which means rock on bones. And what people figured out in the Soviet Union was that X-ray paper could be used to copy record albums. And after World War II, there was tons of used X-ray paper. So someone would smuggle in, someone would get, probably from St. Petersburg or the Baltic Republics up there, closer to Western culture, they'd get a record, and they'd record it. They'd cut it out in a circle, and they'd record it. And they'd go through all through the Soviet Union, and you knew where you were in the order by how good it was, because every recording lost quality. But I was looking up information about Elvis in these, because, you know, you can get a lot of things. And sure enough, on the U.S. Diplomacy Center website, they have, as one of their the photographs posted there, an album, Rok na Kostiak, or Rock on Bones, of Got a Lot of Living to Do, that was obtained by a diplomat who served in Moscow from 1958 to 1960. And he got it off. So they were getting that music. And then one of the great stories is, in 1989, the first Elvis Presley album was pressed in the USSR. You know, the Glasnost is a time of opening. And the album was That's All Right, which was translated as Всё в порядке, which is what somebody asks. Like, everything cool, everything fine? Всё в порядке means, is everything in order? That's kind of like a thing you ask.
Is everything in order, Mama? No, that's not the
song. Yeah, exactly. Well, they didn't include Mama, so I guess they left that one off. But then I read, UPI reported in 1990 that Graceland had been contacted by a group in the Soviet Union, and this is in the middle of 1990, that was forming called the All Union Association of Rock and Roll Fans in Moscow, that was forming an official rock and roll club. They wanted it to be based on, they're the biggest fans of Elvis Presley, and they wanted help in setting up a restaurant in Moscow called Memphis that was going to be an Elvis Presley theme. I didn't find out if they ever did it. It wasn't there when I was there, 20 years later. But I think that's a fascinating story, and it speaks to it. As soon as culture opens up, what's the first thing that people are, one of the first things people are working on getting? Elvis, celebrating Elvis.
It may well be that Elvis won the Cold War. Why don't we go around and say what our favorite Elvis song or album is? For me, it was the last one, Moody Blue. It was just polished sound. He was doing things, interesting things with his voice.
Well, I always liked Elvis Presley's version of the song Don't.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
I don't want to get in copyright trouble.
Please, Bruce, come on, sing.
Don't.
You sang on our podcast.
Don't.
Elvis, was a cassette tape, Elvis, like Rockabilly Elvis, and then Little Sister was on there, and Don't, and I just remember those songs very well.
Well, I got to say, that two songs that I love. One is Suspicious Minds.
Real good one. His last number one hit on the pop charts.
That was great. And then also I've got a bit of an attachment to the song In the Ghetto.
Yes.
Just because in my high school Bible class, we were learning about cities in Israel and the Middle East, and we learned about Megiddo. And so for the rest of the semester, we just kept on making up lines about the Bible lesson about Megiddo and just going, In Megiddo.
Well, that was a song that really plays into the slightly political Elvis, that he did choose to sing that song and enjoyed playing that song. He's a little reluctant at the beginning because it had a message, but that shows you that he wasn't always immune to some political message, that he wanted to highlight troubles in inner cities, and that was part of that comeback special when he did break away a little bit from the Colonel, and it shows you where his head was at. And
didn't he have a medley at one point at the end, towards the end of his career, that was the Battle Hymn?
Oh, yes. That was 70s. It was the mixture of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Dixie, and I don't know the song, but it's, don't you cry, you know your daddy is bound to die, something like that. But it was this mix of these quite powerful.
Yeah.
If wasn't for that copyright, I'd have it running underneath us. But go YouTube it now after you listen to this.
Got to do when you get clearance. That doesn't cost us an arm and a leg.
This Bruce. Podcasting, they're just robbing us. We're like the miners of the 49. You know, we get a little gold, but they're taking all the money on the shovels. Well, guys, really, thanks so much. I've been looking forward to this day. This is going to be a great episode for my listeners. You're listening to Bob Crawford and Dr. Ben Sawyer of the Road to Now podcast.
We're honored, Bruce.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. If you enjoyed our conversation with Bruce Carlson, check out his podcast, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, available anywhere you get The Road to Now. We want to thank our Patreon members for their continued support, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Peggy Donica, Jeff LeCain, and Fig White. To join our team of patrons and get extra content, you can go to patreon.com/theroadtonow, or just go to theroadtonow.com, our website, and click on the support tab at the top of our page. If you're unable to support us financially, that's okay. We've all been there before. You can still support us, though, by telling a friend about our podcast and by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. That only takes a few minutes, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like almost always, is by the talented and lovely Paul DeFiglia. For the Road to Now crew, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care.